This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. We'll begin today with the latest on the brutal kidnapping and murder of South Boston resident Amy Lord earlier this week. The Boston Globe is now reporting that Lord was beaten inside her apartment building early Tuesday before her attacker forced her to drive to five banks to withdraw money.
A few hours later, police found Lord's Jeep on fire in South Boston, and a biker discovered her body at Stony Brook Reservation in Hyde Park.
Law enforcement authorities have released a picture of Amy Lord getting out of her car wearing workout gear with bright pink running shoes. Suffolk County District Attorney Dan Conley is asking for the public's help in tracking Lord's movements early Tuesday morning.
No matter how small or tangential it may seem to you, the public's eyes and ears might provide us with very critical evidence. We need to find justice for Amy Lord, for her family, and her friends.
Meanwhile, the Globe is also reporting that unnamed sources in the police department are calling 28-year-old Edwin Alamany a person of interest in the Lord case. Alamany is charged with attempted murder in a separate attack on a woman early Wednesday morning, also in South Boston. He has been sent for mental evaluation in advance of his arraignment.
The savage abduction and murder of Amy Lord raises the question, could she have prevented the attack? Earlier today, we talked with Gershon Ben Karen, who teaches self-defense in Charlestown, including free classes for women.
Karen teaches Krav Maga Yashir, a system of self-defense developed by the Israeli military. He stressed that we still know too little about what happened to Amy Lord, but he did talk to us about approaches to self-defense, especially for women, and suggested that crimes like this often raise at least one important question.
One of the first questions I always ask myself when looking at these situations is, what was the victim's relationship with the attacker? We tend to build models of violence which, for most people, look at being attacked and assaulted by a stranger. That might well be the case, but I'm always interested how an attacker and assailant gets access to somebody. And obviously, if the person is known, it's much easier for that person to gain access to them. I then tend to look at what in the story looks possibly out of place. And this comes into how we train situational awareness, which is to identify things in the environment that just don't fit, that look a little bit weird. This isn't anything to do with victim blaming, but we do talk about victim facilitation, which is the behaviors and actions that we engage in that possibly identify us as a target, and pre-violence indicators, which are those things which an assailant and attacker has to do before they actually launch an assault.
Say more about what you just called victim facilitation. I'd like to understand a little bit more about that.
There was a study done in 1984 by two psychologists, Grayson and Stein. They set up a video camera and just filmed people walking. They then took that footage to criminals who'd been incarcerated for violent crime and asked them to identify who it was who they'd pick as victims. There was something like an 84% agreement amongst these people who were shown the footage separately. Graysonstein then took the footage and looked at the movement patterns. What were those nonverbal cues that allowed a convicted predator to identify somebody? And they kind of picked up on three things. One was an unnatural stride length to height. So people who might be taking very short steps or very long steps, a fluidity of movement where the arms moved out of sync with the legs. Another one was eyeline down. People normally associate eyeline down with you just not being able to see what's going on. But it's also an emotional signal of depression. And somebody who's feeling low about themselves is unlikely to be fighting back. So these would be things where somebody's not to blame, but these are signals that are sent out to predatory individuals.
I see. So one of the quick lessons there is look confident, look like you know where you're going, have a sense of sort of purpose about you?
Absolutely. It's not a bulletproof self-defense strategy, but you're certainly heading in the right direction.
Now, let me ask you about this notion of compliance. We all hear this again and again, that if you're approached by someone who means to do you harm and might be armed with a knife or a gun, comply. Give him what he wants, because that's the safest thing you can do. Again, we don't know what happened to poor Amy Lord, but it seems like compliance didn't help her here.
Compliance in many types of assault, such as muggings and street robberies, is totally advisable. If somebody's asking for possessions, mobile phone, wallet, hand it over. That has to change, though, when you become the target of the assault. When somebody wants to move you from your primary location where the assault occurs to a secondary location, that primary location represents your best survival opportunity. That's why the person wants to move you from it. They're going to move you from it to somewhere which is in their interest, which helps them facilitate the crime.
So in that case, obviously, it's not about compliance. It's about resistance, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I have to say that each situation is totally different, and we don't teach a kind of rules-based approach of do this, don't do that. But our basic decision tree is if somebody wants you to hand over something, you hand it over. If they still remain at the scene of the crime or want to move you away from that scene of the crime, then it's time to really start looking at physical solutions.
Talk a little bit about what happens to us psychologically when we're faced with this situation, because I think we all have this instinct to say, I'm okay now, I'm still okay, so I'm going to continue doing what I'm doing because I'm still safe. That seems like it would perpetuate a situation that could eventually get us into deeper trouble.
I mean, one of the things, human beings are so adverse to pain that if any action we take doesn't lead to pain, we'll normally continue with that action. So we continue to comply even when our head is screaming at us, look, this isn't going in a good direction. One of the things that happens in all assaults, the first instinct that we go through is denial. This isn't happening to us. We then go through a process of deliberation where we try and work out a solution. We then reach decision, and then we move to action. Every time we reach a decision and we don't act upon it, we're basically confirming to ourselves that we shouldn't act. So if we think, this is my best opportunity now to escape, and we don't act upon it, the next time another opportunity comes along, we tend to have reinforced that behavior and not take that opportunity either.
So let me just ask this sort of hypothetical situation. I mean, let's say, okay, I'm not big, I'm 5'9", I weigh 160 pounds. Let's say I'm confronted by someone who outweighs me by a good 80 pounds and clearly wants to get me into a car or else he's going to do something. And I'm complying, but then I'm hearing Gershon Ben-Koren's voice in my head saying, don't comply because your best opportunity to survive is to remain in this place. How do I do that?
You don't have to beat that other individual physically. What you have to do is prevent them from doing what they want to do to you. So if they want to get you into a car, you have to prevent them getting you into the car. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to physically damage them to the extent where they're lying on the floor and you're sort of standing over their carcass. If you can break away from them, if you can stick a finger in the eye, a thumb in the eye, strike the groin, cause that momentary lapse of, you know, concentration on what they're doing and make a breakaway, that's fine. It might be that simply screaming and shouting will work. Again, there's not like definite prescribed solutions, but the criminal's greatest fear is getting caught. And so drawing attention to what's going on and almost dragging out the timeline starts to put pressure on them.
You know, if there's one thing that someone could learn that might not be intuitively obvious to them in the wake of a crime like this, what is it?
My thing would really be the preventative stuff is much, much better. When you actually come down to having to put a physical solution in place, you're really a long way down that timeline of violence. My line really would be look for what's out of place. If there's something that seems strange, it probably is strange. Our fear system has evolved over thousands of years to identify threats and dangers. When that gut instinct is telling you that something's wrong, don't go into a state of denial. Accept that your fear system has been triggered for a reason. Start to make a dynamic risk assessment. Look around. And there are two outcomes from a dynamic risk assessment. The situation you're in is either high risk or it contains unknown risk. There's no such thing as a low-risk situation when your instincts tell you that everything's wrong.
Gershon, I'm curious to ask you, you teach self-defense to women. When a terrible crime like this occurs and earns the kind of publicity that this one has, what happens here? Do you see more women coming in and asking for self-defense courses?
It really does depend on the nature of the crime. When we had the rapist who was operating at the harbor late at night, we saw absolutely no uplift, and we were a bit surprised. When I started to speak to women about this, their basic view was, well, if I don't go down to the harbor between the hours of midnight and 2 a.m., I'm safe. With this assault and murder, it's been slightly different because of the seemingly random nature of it. I think women in Boston are starting to just consider that it could be me. I could be picked off the street. I could be identified as a target. And we have seen a huge spike in interest in the last couple of days. But as horrific as the assault on Amy was, it's still not the most common type of assault that women face. And I think we can tend to focus in on these things and forget that the number of sexual assaults of women in their own home, the number of street muggings, far outweigh these events. And the likelihood that you'll be the victim of this type of crime is a lot less than a lot others. And while people are thinking about personal safety at this time, they should really review personal safety in their entire life rather than just concentrate on this one type of assault.
I think that's really wise advice. Gershon Ben-Koren, thank you so much for talking to us today. We're very, very grateful.
Thank you.
Gershon Ben-Koren is a self-defense instructor at the Krav Maga Yashir Studio in Charlestown. You can find more information about him, including his free self-defense classes for women, at our website, radioboston.org.
Well, stay with us, because when we come back, we'll talk about the hot housing market in Massachusetts. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.